You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey, please drink responsibly.
Welcome to another South Beach session. We're gathering around here again with another old friend. A friend I've had for a long time, not an old friend, although also that. I've got to be careful around him because he can be slightly vain. Has it been 20 years now? Welcome, by the way, is what I meant to say.
Thank you.
To see you, Izzy Gutierrez.
In all of my vanity, I love being here. Thank you. It has been, it's funny you use the word friend, right? Because it's an interesting topic for me altogether. You know, what level of friendship you have with people you call friends. And so you and I don't know if we ever had like an origin story. So I grew up in Miami. I grew up reading your stuff. You're 6 years older than me, 7 years older than me, maybe. But you started so young in the business that it felt like you were there for my entire childhood, which really you weren't. But growing up, it's funny because you just read your stuff. And this is maybe just me. Maybe I just feel a little bit too much. But I felt like I got to know you through what you wrote about other people. I famously remember one story, and this was a time in my life where I was going through a lot of like questioning my emotions. I was so like hardened. I was like, do I have emotions? Like I would ask myself crazy questions. Like if my mom passed away, do I feel like I would cry right now? Right.
Well, how old are you at this point?
Probably like 15, 16, like young high school. Right.
Okay. So you're a young Latin male, coming to terms with feelings sure. that are not talked about very much in our culture.
Right. And so I'm reading.
And I'm 22. I'm 21 okay. or 22 years old, right?
And you, at that age, I'm reading a column, story, whatever you want to call it, that you wrote about, I believe it was a one-year anniversary of Marlon Brown's death, a Miami Hurricane player. And again, I'm in school reading this, and I start crying. And it settles a lot of issues for me. It says, oh, wow, I really can cry. That's one thing. But also, like, what you are doing is coming across to a level that's affecting me. And not only did I read that and say, man, this guy's really good, but I got a little bit more of a sense of your ability to reach out and feel, you know, what other people are feeling and to get that across. And, you know, so as I keep going,
Barnes had been murdered, mm-hmm. correct? Right. A University of Miami football player who had been murdered under mysterious circumstances. And so you're just reading a profile about him, and wow, I did not know that.
It's about his, you know, you were talking to his family and the 1 year anniversary of it, and all of it was just so raw and so well done. It had me emotional. And so I don't know if I connect with people like that too, because what I find myself is my one strength is like I can read people well. You know, I understand people, what they're going through, what their emotions are. And so I understood you, which is odd, because I'd never met you. And then it was probably the one major element that got me to want to be in journalism. Because when I was in high school, like I just said, you know, I can do anything. I felt like I could, you know, go into any field and be successful. I didn't have anything pinpointed. And then, you know, when I got into journalism because my sister was in the yearbook class and I kind of stayed in yearbook and then I would read your stuff and I was like, wow, this might be something that I want to do. I want to be able to take this person's words or this person's experience and share it with everybody so they can understand it, right? So put, you know, other people in your shoes, which is the best way to, you know, kind of go around the world and understand anybody. And as I get into this business, I eventually in 2002 started working at the Miami Herald. And I probably ran into you a couple of times when I was at the Palm Beach Post, when you were just working at the Herald in a competing newspaper. But there was never, like, by the time this hour is over, however long we're here, this will be the most we've ever spoken in one sitting. Like, so when you say friends, it's just like, I feel like there's a lot of unspoken stuff between you. Like, I feel like I get you, you don't have to say things, and you get me in a sense, and you won't have to say things. Like, not that we haven't done things that, you know, like you tried to support me for a project that I was doing, which was crazy. Like, I don't think anybody would ever give me that sort of blind support. And, you know, we've talked to you when I was coming out publicly. I've talked to you at other times. Most, and even though we haven't had that, you know, long-term connection, and I think it's just kind of one of those things where, like, I feel like I understand you and you feel like you understand me. And if we sat and talked for a long time like we're going to do now, we might find out more details that we didn't know before. But I think the overall picture is still going to be pretty much what you had in mind.
What it is that I have in my head of more substantive conversations that we've had, because I wouldn't identify this as that rare of an occurrence. I would I have sort of the landmarks on lunch tables, right, and places that we were visually where we were having conversations, I would say, of uncommon depth and at times of both crisis and enlightenment. Like I have, but they're sort of landmarks. Mm-hmm. They're lighthouses. They're not things that, as I recall, they're fairly substantive life events.
Yeah, I mean, if you go from, you know, me coming out to my friends and family, which, you know, you were a part of that. I came out to you before, you know, the rest of the world did. Knew that. And then whether it be the public one, whether it be getting married, whether it be getting divorced, whether it be losing, you know, my ex-husband who passed away in 2020, or, you know, wanting to be more of a representative for the LGBTQ community, like all of these things I've gone to you for. And frankly, like, you know, a lot of people have this voice in their head, you know, this their conscience or whatever. And like, frankly, a lot of time growing up, like having read you and having listened to you on the radio and you having this sort of very unique perspective on things, not really unique, just a proper perspective on things, which I think is unique. You were kind of like my conscience a lot of the time. Like I would try to, you know, say what would it, whether it be like in a sports setting or whether it be professional setting or a personal setting, like there'd be a lot of times where I would think, you know, what would Dan think? What would Dan say in this scenario? And I've said this a couple of times out loud, and it's kind of weird. I never said it to you, obviously. You know, people grow up, you know, they have dad issues. You know, they have like, try to please my father, blah, blah, blah. My father and I didn't really have a great relationship growing up. My father, you know this, I've talked to you about this before. He's just very classic, you know, Latino machismo, like just worked, you know, delivered bread and milk, you know, worked all night, slept all day, kind of just didn't really, was just kind of checked in on the kids every once in a while, but wasn't really an active parent. And so I never felt the need to, you know, to prove him anything. You know, I never, it never was. In fact, when I was 5 years old, I remember going to school, kindergarten, the first time saying to myself, yeah, I just want to be the opposite of what my dad is. Like, he's just a guy who works too hard, doesn't do enough, you know, personal stuff for the family, is not the type of personality that I like. Frankly, it was probably a little racist. Not frankly, I'm pretty sure he was racist. Pretty sure he was a homophobe, all these things. And so it's just like, I don't want to be that. And so as I'm getting older and as I continue to go and I'm just like comparing myself to, I realized I didn't have a dad problem. I had Dan issues. Like I was honestly like trying to impress someone. And it turned out that even though it wasn't really you, that it was kind of you in my head, because you kind of have that, I don't know, that sort of that perspective that I feel like I want to have in my life.
Oh, wow. If I had known that, I probably, I mean, in saying that, I'm assuming that I have disappointed you by not being warmer than that, because I did not realize that you were putting me in that place. And I didn't really realize until right now that probably somewhere in your dad stuff, you probably never felt accepted to be whoever you were.
I mean, so that went beyond my dad. Like that, I'm super aware of things. Like I live in this world and I realize that the whole world is telling me you can be anything you want, just don't be gay. And so I had already known that my father was part of that team, if you will. And that was why, in large part, I just kind of held out, if you will, for my whole life, just saying, hey, you know, maybe something will change. And so I wouldn't have to deal with that. And, you know, my dad had a major stroke in 2005 and he's still with us. And I'm surprised he's actually lasted this long, but our communication, like we can't really communicate very well. At this point, he barely speaks, but even when he did have it, it was just expressive aphasia. So he couldn't really get the thoughts out that were in his head. And the English that he had known, whatever it was, percentage that he had known before was already gone. So it was just Spanish, and my Spanish is terrible. And so him and I communicating was never good. And then, you know, I actually came out to him in this condition, and I was so frightened by it that it was not, even though there was nothing he could have done to me, right? He was literally bedridden and couldn't do anything, couldn't say anything. It scared the hell out of me. And so actually,
just the idea of it, to be just the child in you that's always been hidden, sort of, even in a state of dementia, that he would be somehow disapproving to you. You're coming to him as an adult in your late 30s, in your
39 years old. And frankly, I didn't even do it myself. I had my sister, my youngest sister, and my mom kind of talk to him for me. I sort of said that my mom's Spanish, that was my excuse, my mom's Spanish would be better. And he just kind of responded with, you know, that's life. And I was surprised by that because, you know, he was a hothead. He was a jerk. He was a guy who would get drunk with his friends and just like get too loud and they'd kick him out and stuff. And so when he no longer can really speak and communicate with anybody, but he's still sort of consuming what's going on in the world around him by watching, you know, the news or whatever, he can't combat it, right? He can't argue back. So he just kind of consumes it. And so I can just see in his face that he's just like, the world is not what I thought it was. And you are a perfect example of that, because I see more love in his eyes now when I see him than I ever did my entire life, you know? And I knew he was proud of me. Like he got the Miami Herald, the Nuevo Herald. Like he would super proud when you see my, you know, my name in there, but never really got across. Like now, you know, over the last 10 years or so, I just walk in front of him and he sees me and there's just like glow of happiness in front of him. I'm just like, God damn it. Why didn't you just tell me that before? You know, why didn't you just show me that before? And so it's a whole different, it's a weird dynamic. Cause it's like now, even though he is, you know, like he's a burden to my mother, you know, my mother's had to take care of him for 18 years in this condition, but I want him around longer than ever now, more than ever now, because I know he sees me now and he never saw me before. So all that stuff is just like, you get to a certain age and you realize all that stuff. And I think I handled things pretty well, you know, coming up, given all those circumstances. But you also think about it, and it's just like, shit, like that stuff affected me somehow. I don't really know how exactly. Maybe it was like a crippling lack of confidence, despite the fact that, you know, I was pretty good at things that I did.
How could it not result in loneliness to not feel that a person whose admiration you were craving wasn't meeting you with understanding or acceptance?
Well, that's the part that gets me, though, because I didn't feel like I was craving it, because I had like my mom, my sisters, my uncle, aunts, like I had a bunch of family, like they were right there for me. Like I had all the support that I needed, you know, even, you know, in friendships, even though I was never really close, as close as anybody, because I couldn't tell them my innermost thoughts in terms of my sexuality, I still had good friends. I still had, you know,
but
good
aren't you, forgive me here, because you and I haven't talked about this stuff. I recall actually being surprised that you would honor me with needing to tell me that you were gay. I didn't totally understand why you would need to tell me, but it's wrapped in here somewhere, isn't it? Like the idea that you would not, that your father wouldn't accept who at your core you were, that you would have to hide something from your father.
I think the conversations that I wanted to have at that point did not include me having to explain what it meant to be gay. You know what I mean? Did not mean having to defend myself. And I think I went to people who I knew already had that information in the back of their head, who knew that people are people. And, you know, even you, you told me that, you know, back in the day, whether it was, I don't know if it was you or your dad, but one of you guys, you said that you guys were like kind of homophobic back in the day, and you just obviously worked your way through it. I think it was your dad, but anyway.
Grandparents, actually, uncles, just an orchestra of Latin band men coming from a different time. Famously homophobic. Yeah. What I grew up around was a lot of older men who that was the slur that was used to dismiss someone's masculinity.
And so when I'm coming out, I don't need to have to explain to someone like what it is that I am, how I'm feeling, why it's okay before I get to, you know, my feelings. And it's like my mom, it's crazy. When I came out to my mom, she actually asked me the question. She was like, is there anything you could say other than gay? Because that sounds bad, right? And I was just like, no, mom, like that's the right word to use these days. You know what I mean? And so it was too much responsibility for me. So I leaned on people that I knew already had that part in the background. You know, you, Tony Reale, people that, you know, had this emotional bandwidth and just emotional, you know, connection that could understand that how somebody is feeling, even though they're not going through it themselves. So I think that was a big part of it.
I don't know, though, that I still understand, though, why it would be necessary, right? I don't remember what my reaction was.
I do. Your reaction was one of a few similar reactions that I had where you were just kind of like, yeah, because it felt like you knew already, which is crazy because growing up, honestly, Dan, I thought you were gay for about like a year of my time because I had known enough about you to know you feel things very well, right? You famously didn't want to get married or had kids. And I'm just like, I know that playbook a little bit. Uh-huh. And then it didn't take very long after actually meeting you being like, oh, yeah, no, that was just some nonsense I created in my head. There could actually be, men, hetero men like you who actually do and say and feel these things. But, and when I thought about it, I was just like, oh, that'd be a great get for us. But for the most part, I was like, no, I actually think that that is more important to have thoughtful, allies who just understand. Not that I feel like you can speak for me at any given time, but I trust most of the time when you have something to say on the matter that it is the right thing to say. There are times where it's not. There are times when you discuss things where I just kind of cringe and I'm just like, I wish I was there right now. Fortunately, sometimes Jess capes up for me and doesn't even know it.
I've got blind spots.
Yeah,
sure.
I mean, it is. Everybody does. But, from where I come from, from my perspective, I trust you a ton. And I think that even if you had a blind spot, that if somebody showed it to you, you would, snap out of it.
But I don't think that I knew. It doesn't seem like something that I would care to know or would be any of my business. I don't recall my reaction being anything other than being surprised that you would honor me by telling me something that wasn't any of my business.
Well, I mean, to me, I just thought at that point, I was like 39. Wait, maybe I was a little younger than that, but I was in my 30s, and mid-30s at the earliest. And it was just like one of those where you're just a smart guy, hadn't seen me around with women, hadn't talked to me, I hadn't talked about women a lot, and so you just kind of just figured it out at that
point.
Well,
John Amici was trying to tell me he was gay forever with rainbow towels and an assortment of TiVo programming that would have made it obvious. And It wasn't something that I was thinking about until you and John Amici sort of helped me understand better what a lonely path it could be in sports and in this business to have that. It seems crazy to say in retrospect, but from an antiquated time, to have to feel like you're always hiding in front of people because it's not a friendly environment.
Yeah, and that's the that's the part that drives me nuts. And frankly, one of the things that you talk about, you have in the past, is that Dave Chappelle. Whenever he comes up, I kind of want to fast forward through it because I know where you stand on it, and I understand there are some takes to be had there. But just the idea that we're all we're fighting a similar fight. There's no line, there's no anything. It's frustrating as hell when you've got an entire group of people who are just trying to live their lives. And they feel like they have to fight every step of the way, every second of the day. It's exhausting, man. I've gotten to a point where I have to actively avoid, Twitter. I don't really watch the news, but anything that offers the news while I'm prepping for work. Because I just feel targeted. I feel attacked. I feel, you got DeSantis in this state just turning back the clock on hatred. And just it's insane how powerful that is. It's insane how much like John Amici, I love so much because he's so strong mentally to have to put up with this shit all the time and have people just and he has the perfect response every time, it feels like. And I just can't imagine being that level of just calm and because I mean, one of my biggest issues is just I have a lot of thoughts and I have trouble reeling it in and just focusing them, right? Especially when it comes to something like this. I feel like I'm being attacked from all, areas of the world, and I just don't know what to do. I want to do something, but I can't just go on Twitter and just say shit because it's just going to be an argument there. I can't come on here and say shit because it's just going to be people saying, why are you ruining the show? I don't want to think about serious thoughts. And it's just at some point we have to think about this stuff. And, for most people, literally most people, the LGBT stuff doesn't actually affect them. It's just, oh, it's terrible what they're doing over there, but it doesn't actually affect them. And meanwhile, I get out of my car every time I go to a bar and I'm just kind of looking around. I'm like, is this the time? Am I going to be, the next victim? Or, I'm at an event with a drag queen and it's just you know, is this going to be the one that's targeted? I actually have, this is crazy to say this, I actually have a pool party that we're sort of using as a fundraiser for our Travel Flag football team. I'm afraid to post it on social. I'm afraid to post it on social because I happen to be somebody that's, you know, has some sort of fame, and it could target my specific party.
It's gotten worse, right?
Absolutely insane.
It seemed hopeful, like it seemed more hopeful 10 years ago when some of this stuff was better hidden. It seems like there has been regression, that the regression in the legislation, the regression in the amount of hate would make it feel, would be a reminder of how unsafe it is.
Yes. And I mean, we see it every day. It doesn't have to be about LGBTQ issues. Like, we see it every day. The people that just so fed up and just, you know, I mean, we've seen what's happening out here. But I think with the LGBTQ community, for me in particular, like, I've never felt more connected with the group of people. You know, I can feel all their pain and all their suffering, and just, I'm so proud of, like, whether it be young, you know, gay people who come out and just live their lives, or older people who have come out, you know, even after marriage and having kids, and come out and live their lives. Like, that's so difficult to do. And it's, I'm just, you know, I cowered and I stayed, you know, in the closet till I was 31 years old. And I, like, regret that. I regret that so much because, you know, my relationship with my family would have been better. My friendships would have been better. My friendships are very awkward. Like, it's just, you know, I don't know. Like, I want to have these deep connections with people and stuff, but, you know, other people don't necessarily. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of people have this sort of bandwidth for emotional connections. And once you have, like, I'm 45, so my friends should be in their 40s, right? What do most people have in their 40s? They have families. They have things to worry about. They have this kid, you know, that they have to give all their effort and love to. And they have this person that they need to, you know, protect or provide for, or vice versa. And, like, I don't have those same connection points. Like, I can't, you know, I saw Tony Reale did something, a post, you know, talking about how over the years of Around the Horn, one of the things that gets him to recognize, you know, how these years have passed is looking at the pictures and the photos of all these kids, of all the panelists. And I'm just like, eh, it sucks. Like, I wish I could, you know, have a family and do all that stuff. And so it's just so much all the time to just kind of, like, you know, figure out. And, like, I don't have normal friendships, you know. I have a handful, but, like, even now, as like I said, as a 45-year-old, like, mostly hanging out with, like, people in their 20s and early 30s because, you know, I, again, don't have the family, don't have all that stuff to discuss. And so it's just, like, I don't know. It's one of those, I'm in a sweet spot in my life where I feel like I've gained enough knowledge, I'm comfortable, I can sort of have any conversation with anybody, but I also still feel like I'm feeling things out. And that includes stuff like, you know, friendships, that includes stuff like, you know, work relationships even, and it just, you know, it affects
I would imagine emotionally, though, I can only imagine, but once you arrive into your 30s, having hidden something from people for so long, that you are basically, in terms of emotional growth, you have been a gay man in front of people publicly for 14 years. That's teenage years, from 1 to 14, where you've been allowed to be publicly yourself, to be yourself in front of everybody without a whole lot of hiding there. It just, that seems like a very superficial way of gathering it, but if you're making the conclusion that you don't have connection points with people who are 45 in your age, is because you've had a different life experience.
Yes, and I feel that way. Like, I've always felt, it's professionally, you know, getting into the business at such a young age, and I'm at 22 years old covering the Florida Marlins, and you got, you know, Dave O'Brien, former South Florida Sun Sentinel writer, now he's at the AJC, telling you, whatever happened to, you know, having to pay your dues, and I'm sitting here, I feel like a kid, right? And so, you know, you keep going in that business, in our business, and until I get to my 30s, I'm always going to feel like a kid, right? You feel like the young one. But then when I realized after I came out and I was basically, like you said, living the life of, you know, late teenager, early 20s, where you're just kind of, oh, I found love for the first time. I'm experiencing all these things. Then you definitely feel like the kid again, because it's just like, oh, that's what all these people were experiencing. That, and then, you know, fast forward to even after my divorce, when, you know, I've talked about this a bunch of times. I got cheated on, divorced him right away. He has since passed away. We can get to that if you want to. But after that happened, I realized, oh, I haven't been living my life the correct way. I've just been living the way it works for me. And so all these things that I'd never tried before, like I didn't drink until I was in college. I never smoked weed until I was like my mid-30s. I never tried like party drugs, anything. I was like, why the hell not? Why not? Because everything else is going to shit right now. And so even that in itself was just like, I went to Vegas for the first time and partied a bunch. And it was just like, oh, wow. Like I have a lot more connection points with people. I understand a lot of these things. I'm doing these things at a time in my life where, you know, I feel like I've got my mind all together and I feel like all this stuff isn't going to affect me in any sort of negative way. And so I'm just doing it. And I'm just like, oh, now I've like at 40, understand what a lot of people are going through at 20, 21, 22 years old. And so it feels like I'm kind of living my life in reverse because I was the buttoned up always, you know, professional and just trying to, you know, succeed in life, school, professionally, et cetera. And now, finally, halfway through, or maybe a third of the way through, I plan on living until I'm 120, I get some things that other people have been, you know.
Starting is everything when it comes to fitness. Peloton helps you start no matter what level you're at. Wherever you're starting, there's thousands of classes to get you moving. Whether that's beginners or advanced rides, feel-good live DJ rides, or artist-themed rides, they've got something for you. Peloton bike instructors keep you motivated from day one. They'll show you the basics, help take the guesswork out of your workout, and encourage you to build from there. And now with Peloton Entertainment, you can keep moving and watch your favorite TV shows and live sports as you ride. Perfect for those days when you don't want to miss a thing. And if you don't have a bike, take a dance class, take a core class, take Pilates, take a stretching class, start a program with Andy, do a core program with Emma. You can do it all at Peloton. You can get a Peloton row, and you're not even going to get wet because it's inside your own house without water. How'd they do it? I don't know. Wherever you're starting, get moving with a Peloton bike or bike plus rental at onepeloton.com/bike rentals. Terms apply.
Were you hiding in your work like I was in your 20s so that you didn't have to look at some of the stuff and you can just concentrate on ambition and getting ahead?
1,000%. And it wasn't just as a distraction. It was in the back of my head as a way to legitimize myself to the public because something's coming. You know what I mean? It was always the biggest, like people are just like, oh, who cares? Yeah, I wish people don't care, didn't care. But my goodness, it's the one thing that's in the front of my brain at all times, especially when you are, you know, hiding it or you're getting to the point where I was when I was hitting 30. And it's just like, all right, this isn't going to be this easy anymore.
You have it on a number of fronts that would force you into hiding. It is Latin masculinity. It is sports writing. And it's the locker room of sports. You were coming up during a time where it was not comfortable to be out in the open. You would feel very alone here.
Yeah, 1,000%. And like, I was tested very early on, and it was to me. I thinking about it in the well past, in retrospect, it makes me realize just how guarded I was without really recognizing it. Right. So I'm in the Marlins clubhouse. 22 years old, just out of school. Like I no longer have that protection, right? I went to school at Florida, so I went away from home. So I was a little, but you're still in school, right? You still feel like you're safe. You still got your college roommates, whatever. You're out in their professional world my first year. And, you know, I didn't really know how people were going to respond to things. I didn't really know what the locker room was like, what have you. When I see the players interact with each other, I'm like, okay, maybe they're cool. They seem to be fine, right? But one time, I showed up with an earring in my left ear up in the cartilage, right? I'd had one, I think, in the lobe, but then I was like, let me see what it looks like up here. So I get into the two people. First, it was before I got to the Marlins clubhouse, it was Howard Schnellenberger asking me if I was queer because I had that in my ear. And obviously, I had to immediately lie to his face. And then Antonio Alfonseca, one time in the Marlins clubhouse, just asked me if I'm like this because I have this thing in my ear. And then he was like, no? Okay, then you have to take that out because that's not. And I was just like, whatever, man. And the next day it was out of my ear. But I didn't sit there and think, oh my God. Like, I just like, it's like, all right, I think I'm good. Not going to think about that ever again. Even though, like, it was right there in front of you. They're just like, it's a scary effing moment. And so, I think early on, I just kind of had to deal with that. And then it made me recognize that, yeah, this is, especially in a baseball clubhouse. And you know this, Dan, like, whether it be the Latins in the baseball clubhouse that just don't have that level of education in terms of the LGBTQ community, or just, you know, players coming out of high school, not going to college, and just, you know, knowing what they grew up around. And it was, that's the, probably the worst place for that to happen. And so I just kind of like put it in the back and just like kept going. And so when I actually did come out, I didn't imagine that it would be that bad because, I don't know, I felt like times have progressed and that stuff was in the past, or those folks couldn't say these things out loud. Whereas now, I feel like anybody can say anything they want.
Help me out with something here, because it sounds like I hurt you or disappointed you with the way that I have expressed admiration for the craft of what Dave Chappelle does and trying to separate art from artist on watching something that I have admired, which is Chappelle, to come through the Hollywood labyrinth and be able to keep his name and his power at the end, while also within that saying that he shouldn't be doing what he is doing, that he should be, as a comedian who grows, he should be an ally to other minority vulnerable groups that are under siege.
So that's where you've landed with Dave, with Chappelle?
Because, well, I don't know that there's a clear place that I can land. I like his comedy. I like the art. I'm awed by the skill set of what it is that he's able to do. And his story is also interesting to me as a black comedian and black entertainer. And I think he's been wrong to do what he has done to the trans community and not let go of it.
Is there, I just want to make sure I'm not missing something. Did he backtrack? Did he say anything sort of in an apologetic manner? No, right? So what's the point then in comparing? What's the point? Like, why are you taking down the trans community, in large part because you don't understand, but also because the idea that they are fighting for their own civil rights, their own freedoms, their own lives, like, why is that something that should be compared to any other group's struggles or oppression? Like, it should be, there should be relatable points more than anything, but to suggest that, you know, to wait in line or all that comes from the idea that you don't think that their issues are the same. And the idea that, you know, it's not as difficult because you can hide being gay or whatever it is anywhere in the rainbow. And it's just like, do you know that that's just 10 times more damaging? Like, if I had to go around pretending to be somebody else my whole life, then I would not be me. You're literally trying to take away my entire identity. And why? Because it's not our turn yet? It's not, it's maddening to me. You know, we should show support for each other, because we are, like, this whole, like, concept of just, like, the world is changing and everything's getting out of control. No, we're just evolving, man, and people are more free to be who they are. And that's all that is. It's just, it's maddening, and I respect a lot of, you know, intelligent, brilliant artists. But if I then can't listen to what they're saying without thinking of some of the things that they've said in the past, then it ruins them for me. And he has essentially been ruined. And when I watch other comedians like James Acaster, it's just so freaking brilliant. Doesn't even come close. Doesn't even come close to pissing people off that way. Because you don't have to be funny. You don't have to be a genius. You're just tackling things that, you know, your genius is deciding that you want to tackle. But that doesn't mean you're doing it correctly. Like, if you are a trained comedian, you are great at comedy. You can probably turn any subject funny. But in terms of, like, these social matters where you're just stepping in and saying, hey, I'm a smart person, listen to me on this, I don't feel the need to listen to Dave Chappelle the same way I wouldn't feel the need to listen to, like, LeBron James on issues on this same subject, because he is not, you know, he's just not educated enough on the subject, and he's just not the person who really understands our plight, it seems, based on what he's saying. And so it's just frustrating. And so, like, I understand, you know, the separating the art from the artist, but there are times where I just cannot do that. And that has to do with, you know, once that voice, that face, once it's affected me into where I'm thinking of something other than the product right in front of me, ruined it for me. Same thing with R. Kelly songs. Like, I can't get my reminder, especially if it's a lyric that reminds you of, oh, wow, that's what he did. Like, I can't separate those things. I'm sorry.
Did you get to what it is that you wanted to be doing professionally whenever it is that you imagined, whenever it is that you decided at 15, 16 years old, that you were going to do something with your life that would be telling stories to others, yeah, and enjoying a sports job that can often not feel like a job.
Yeah, so my life has gone way better than I thought it would. When I graduated at UF, I was a professor there who asked me where I wanted to be in 10 years. And I said, well, I want to be at a major metropolitan newspaper covering an NBA team. And I was doing that within 10 months. And so at that point, I was like, I don't really have a secondary goal here, a backup goal. And so I'm just not going to set goals. And as I kept going, I just kept, you know, believing that everything I did was merit-based and just like, all right, I'm going to keep going. And, you know, I got to a point in 2012 where ESPN hired me. And by then I had already been doing some work for them as a freelancer, been on TV, so I've been noticed a little bit. But, you know, the explosion that comes after, you know, being on Around the Horn for a decade and like, you know, you're walking around the streets in different parts of the country and like I'm in Atlanta and there's people yelling out of their cars my full name and I'm just like, what is happening? Like, this is an absolute crazy situation for me, especially when you consider like...
Television's powerful, man.
Yeah, especially when you consider like the things that I want to do, the things that I want to talk about now aren't really like sports related. Like sports, you know, I've been at it for a long time. Like, I mean, you took a sabbatical because it was just all too much of like... the sports stuff.
Well,
right?
It feels silly. It can feel, yeah. It can, if you're not doing substantive work, it could feel after many years that you're wasting your time on things that don't have worthiness.
And that's exactly why I love hearing these comments from, you know, fans or whatever, because it's just a constant reminder that, like, that's why they like you. That's why, you know, they know you. And it's okay if I fell out of love with it a little bit. What I still love is just giving those folks something. You know what I'm saying? Like, I hate when I'm watching something in you know, a news show or a sports show in the background, and there's just nothing there where I can just be like, oh, yeah, that person has a good point. I just want to give them something to hang on to, something to make them say, that guy cares like I do. And, you know, maybe even if it's something that I've already thought about, like, oh, I agree with you, or give you something that I haven't thought about. Like, that's what really matters is not that I'm right, not that I got this, just that somebody connected and said, hey, yeah, I get that, and then that makes sense. And if it's the most benign of things, that's fine, because that's why you're there. Like, you're just there to entertain somebody else. You're not there to pick games, right? Because if you were, you'd just be a gambler.
Oh, but I'm just grateful that people will gather around to listen to anything we have to say in the microphones now more than ever, as you have more and more options on what that is. Like, the idea of someone yelling your name in the street would have been so foreign to me when I chose this as a career. The idea of people making a connection point to you, like the one that you're talking about. You had not told me that. I did not realize that you at as a 15-year-old are reading something and deciding what the rest of your life is going to look like.
To be fair, I didn't decide it right then and there, but that was the point where I looked, when I was making the decision, looked back and said, I never felt anything like that around, you know, law. I was a debate team president, whatever. I was going to be a lawyer. Nothing's ever going to get that level of emotion out of me, you know. And then, you know, I thought back to when I was the most passionate about something, and it was, you know, Knicks Heat on my mom's, you know, recliner, just pissed as hell when Jamal Mashburn doesn't take that shot and I'm cursing left and right. And it's just like, oh, that's what I want to do.
Depth, you know, of feeling.
I don't care about how much money I can make over there. That's what I want to do, so that even if I'm broke, I'm just like, hey, I like what I'm going to do every single day. And so that's why I did it. And yes, reading of that story was like top of the list things. Like, I looked at, you know, the Steve Wyche, Linda Robertson, you know, Greg Cody, and said, yeah, they're all great. I want to join that club. And I would say you were just sort of heading the club.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike. And typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right. You crack that puppy open and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
You found, though, at some point, I don't remember when it was, if you were already writing for the Miami Herald and the Palm Beach Post in your early 20s, that means you achieved or exceeded your dreams by your early 30s, and now you're looking around and you're saying, well, this is, and whether it's 10 years on Around the Horn or not, you're still looking around and saying, okay, is this all there is? Like, is this silly thing? I'm going to tap dance on this silly stage and give you a prediction on game five of this series. No one's going to remember 9 years from now. I remember you for a long time have been questioning the worth of what we do.
I've been questioning the fulfillment of it, which is why it's been helpful to get that perspective from just the interactions with fans, because that part is crazy fulfilling. You know, I don't want to talk to them about, you know, the Dallas Mavericks or anything like that. When I see them, I just want to acknowledge, oh, okay, what I'm doing is worth something. And that has helped a lot. But for the most part, I think, you know, the idea of doing this is, it's gone way past like my wildest dreams. You know, it's not just getting recognized, or I just feel like, oh, if people respect what I'm saying, then I think this whole, or doing or writing, then I trust my own judgment. I trust my own thoughts. This is where I say, like, I'm in a sweet spot in life. Because, you know, there's a time where you just, like, all these lessons you've been learning, they start to kick in. You start to realize, oh, wow, like, I'm wise about a good number of things. I'm knowledgeable about a good number of things. But I'm also not dumb enough to recognize that I can still continue to learn. So it's just like, oh, okay, I'm good offering, let's say, advice on this subject or whatever, but if it's something that I'm not certain about, if there's something that I haven't really, you know, whatever, researched or discussed, I'm a sponge. Like, I really want to know more about it, because, I mean, we're only on here, like, once, depending on what your religion is, what you believe in, but, like, we're only out here for once. And, like,
well, you for 120 years.
Right, 120. And like, my time's running out, I'm telling you, because I didn't even start partying until I was in 40 years old. But I just think, like, I don't know, I think where I love hearing people discuss, you know, me, and like, even if they're getting things wrong, details wrong about my experience with my husband or my, you know, everything else and my marriage, and like, I can hear the level of like discomfort in their having this conversation, but I am part of the reason why they're even willing to have the conversation. And that part to me is just like, it's crazy fulfilling. And so it's actually been a little bit of a turn, you know, and, you know, where I have a fan coming to me outside of a nightclub and saying it's a bucket list check off for her list to have met me. And it's mind boggling. And it's not necessarily because of the sports stuff, but the sports stuff has given me the platform to do any of this or say any of this and have any sort of impact just by existing.
But it's also nice, and it must be truly liberating and fulfilling to feel like you're being seen as well. It's not whatever you were achieving on merit in this industry at 29 when you were still hidden, but you've decided to show the insides of your life to people and to have those people connect there with the vulnerability and accept you and hold you in esteem in a way that feels, if not loving, seen at the very least, would make it less lonely than wandering around hidden in shadows.
It's funny how people think of you versus what you actually, or how you actually exist. And I am curious what people think about me and how I live and stuff like that, because I've always came up in my own head, right? I haven't had people to discuss these things with. So it's all up in here. And so I'm always concerned of what people are thinking of me growing up, and like, oh, they can't possibly like me if they're not outwardly saying as much. And so I am always growing up, always been in my own head.
And it leads to insecurity, right? Because if you're alone with it.
So even to this day, where I'm pretty confident in what I can do, what I can offer, you know, what I do professionally, I, for years, have seen you guys and listened to you guys fly in guests from all parts of the country and get regular run right next to you and Stu, whether it be Mina, Dominique, Bomani, whomever. And when I'm on the show, most of the time it was to fill in for you. And where I see that as, in my head, oh, just to fill in, just because he's local, it's convenient. I actually think other people look at it as, no, he actually does a good job filling in for Dan. And not many people do that. And so in my head, I'm thinking, no chance in hell that people actually like me. And in my head, I'm thinking, you don't like me as much as those others because I'm not here every month or whatever, even though I live in this place.
Taken for granted.
100%.
Because you're the local guy. Dan, taken for granted.
And when you have them, this is how stupid it is, okay? When you have them in here, when it's been 2 months since Dominique comes, he gets a rousing round of applause.
You got nothing today.
I got nothing. Not today, last time. But that's how crazy it is. Like, it doesn't effing matter. I know you don't think anything. I know, like, the guys over there, you know, the people in the shipping container, mission control don't think of me that way, right?
But
in my head, I'm just like, well, why?
That's funny that you would look at it that way. All of those have been visitors that are shipped in from elsewhere. You've been the guy that everyone around here has known since you were a kid.
That's what I'm telling you.
They all grew up. Everyone here grew up with you, grew up reading you, grew up. I mean, some of the people here are young enough to know you from being the person who was on Highly Questionable more than any of the other people. But you're always around.
And mind-boggling to me. Like, to hear you say that. And I have experienced that. Like, I have, you know, met people that's just like, wow, I've watched you my whole life. That's crazy. I can't even think about that. But
see,
I don't think the same way.
Old man. You're old man diarrhea. You are, no matter how muscular you are, and even though we're only a third of the way into your life, you are now officially someone who has grown old next to us.
Yeah. And I love it because I feel like even at this age, like, I can relate to whatever age group, whether it be because I'm sort of stuck in this, you know, 20 to 25 range over the last couple of years, or because I've, you know, I get along with and I vibe with old souls and old people in general. I'm just in this, like, in this wonderful place right now, and I love it. Even my hair has worked out perfectly because, like, everybody loves
great.
It.
You're
everybody
a silver fox. It's much better than the amount of gray that's forming all over me in a way that's not quite as sexy. You have an unusually good relationship with my father because not everyone has those with my dad, and I think it's only because you find him funnier than anyone else does.
I just find, like, it's the same thing with Greg Cody. I just find it humorous that, you know, you put yourself, they've lived their entire lives, had their whole careers, and even Greg's, who's been in a similar medium, not quite, you know, TV and radio, but it's like, they just kind of put themselves in a spot and just like, well, here it is. Let me just, you know, take it all in, or let me just, like, the fact that your dad was on television every single day.
Funny. It's one
and
of
like,
the,
it's the only thing people talk to me about. Him and Stephen A. Smith, even though I never worked with Stephen A. Smith.
It's a funny joke if you have never respected television to put your father on in his second language and have him steal the show from you, because it's all anyone wants to talk to me about either. I spent 8 years slaving on that show, looking for bear videos, bears falling out of trees and landing on a trampoline to entertain the people, and all they want to talk about is my dad.
And where's my head when I'm sitting right next to him and I can hear him breathing and I look at him and I'm just like, oh man, I feel so bad for him because he's just listening for the next line. He's working.
Yes.
Like, your dad was working in that middle seat. And yes. I was just like, everybody else is enjoying this so much, but you're not. Right. That makes me sad.
Well, that part was a bummer, but I suspect you saw the innards of the thing, though. You saw it from an unusually intimate angle where you could see that my dad didn't respect me as the boss and where I would just get, look at him, he still laughs at me. It's like when I complain about Stugatz with anybody and people just burst out laughing at the dinner table because, of course.
Because your dad would always, like, he's obviously got somebody in his ear all this time. Eric Rydholm was in his ear, or whoever was giving him the lines that day. And
you're revealing a secret that I don't think a lot of people know. I mean,
they know he was being fed lines. Come on.
I don't know if they know that he's being fed lines.
So, spoiler alert, if you want to go back in time, he was being fed lines.
I think they think that my father is a 100% authentic personality who was just that clever every single time.
You know what? That is actually fair. There was a good percentage of time where he would play his own hits.
That's right.
He didn't need to be fed.
That's true.
So that's 1,000%.
He was not 100% a puppet.
That's true. Your dad's a genius, actually. And I mean, but for the most part, like, when he was having a good time, that's when it was the best. Like, that's when it was 1,000% like genuine. I love just the fact that this man is sitting here giggling and doing a job he's getting paid for that he never once in his life thought he would ever do.
Well, let me ask you, because you and I have not talked very much about the mechanics of the doing of that show, because it is a weird thing to sit next to a grown man and his father and have chemistry with those two people. Did you spend any time at all examining your relationship with your own father as I sat there next to mine and we played patty cake on television trying to figure out, because I had a better relationship with my father in the later years than I had at any other time, because we could have at least this television show as a connection point.
It didn't make me think of my father and my relationship with him in particular, just because I knew it would never get to that level, even if he hadn't had the stroke, whether it be because of, you know, the language barrier, if he didn't want to speak English and I didn't feel like speaking Spanish, or whether it be because, you know, he wouldn't change his personality the way he grew up. I don't know if that ever would have been what I was longing for, but there was definitely a sense, not of jealousy, but of just wondering, you know, if I could have that male figure in my life that I could have that level of relationship with. Because even when you were upset with your dad and all that stuff, like in the back of your head, it was like, this is my fault. Like, I brought him onto this. So if he's upset, it's because of me in any sort of way. So you're just kind of balancing the whole, let's make good TV with don't piss off my dad, but also thank you, dad. You know, it's just, it's a lot going on there. And, you know, the mechanics of it being, I can feel you from two seats over handling all of that, and yet somehow so eloquently dropping this take that I was just like, son of a bitch, like, I wish I would have had that take, because now I've got to, like, somehow get something that's just slightly different and set up Poppy. And it was just a lot going on, and it had to do with that relationship, because if it was somebody else in the middle, I wouldn't think that you were, you know, worried about everybody. You know, I think you would just worry about yourself. And in this scenario, I felt like doing that show, I felt like you were carrying weight for everybody, all three of us.
I believe that's kind of a curse of mine, though. I'm not sure that...
meaning that you
just
get
for
that
everybody. Well, that I, when we're doing our show in here, if somebody checks out for 6 minutes in the back row, I find myself reaching for them, like, are they okay? Do they want to get in here? The windows are too tight. I mean, they're often editing, or they've been boxed out because we now have 400 people talking at the microphones.
I thought you were going to say they're all boxed out by Tony.
Tony can get to yammering, yes, and he can box people out. You saw something, though, in that show and my father that it felt to me like you and my father loved each other in a way that I thought was beautiful. Like, my father appreciated, you were always so gentle with him. Everybody who was in that seat was more gentle with him than I was, because we come to that show with all the baggage. But you were so remarkably gentle with my father. I don't think he would have a bad thing to say about you.
Well, thanks. I feel like I was just kind of doing what was needed at the moment, probably because you were the opposite of that with him a lot of the time, and just because I recognize the situation. But like, he's you know, he's always just a pleasant man. Like, you just can't be unhappy around him unless, you know, he's sad or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. It's a similar thing. I told you, I just kind of get along well with old souls. Like, your dad's been through some stuff. Your dad, like, went through some shit. Your dad, like, worked his way up to be what he was. And he birthed, you know, you and your brother, and you guys are just, like, being super successful. And it's just like, man, this guy deserves some flowers. He deserves some rest. He deserves some, you know, just to live up his life the way he deserves to. And here he is, you know, just doing it for you.
He's getting all of the rest that he wants now, puttering around the house, making my mom crazy because he just wanted to retire and be an old man. But you've mentioned a couple of different times now as it related to your previous marriage and to your father's health condition. You have mentioned what seems to me a desire to talk about mortality, or talk about being at someone's bedside and forgiving them for hurting you and for harming a love that you don't extend to many.
Yeah, this is one of those things where you just, like, it's kind of like what I was talking about, you know, growing up and not realizing that things should be affecting me the way they are, or whether it be, like, you know, Antonio Alfonseca or any of that stuff. Like, growing up, I mean, living through some of the things that I've lived through recently can be like really tough. So my husband, my ex-husband, this Reader's Digest version, we were together for 8 years, married just for one because he cheated and I divorced him. And at the time that we had met, which was back in 2009, he was 22, I was 31. He was HIV positive. I was not. I still am not. He had a bunch of red flags that I just took them all as challenges. And so, whatever, went through our lives together. We get a divorce. And then he attempted to kill himself, like immediately that same day once I decided that, you know, the marriage was over. And when I told his friends, I said, hey, you might want to check on David. I think he might do something stupid. And they eventually did check on him, and he was on a beach. He was passed out after having taken a lot of drugs, a lot of painkillers, and a lot of alcohol. And they just thought he was drunk. And so, he was an alcoholic. We talked about that in the past. But it's 7 o'clock the next morning, and I've been awake all night. I'm crying in bed, and I call his friend and said, hey, I need to talk to him. Where is he? And they told me he was still in the car. And I said, what? And I raced over there, and I opened their car door, and he was in the back seat, purple, choking, like dying. And I immediately called the ambulance, and they came, and they literally saved his life. They said he wouldn't have lasted another half an hour. He was asphyxiating on his own vomit, that type of stuff. And so he goes into the hospital, and when he is he's sedated, because when he comes to the first time, he loses his mind, and it took 9 employees to hold him down. So they sedated him. And so, meanwhile, this is at a time where I've never hated somebody more, right? Like, the idea of marriage to me is a huge, respectful institution that I care about, you know, because my parents have always been together. And he ruined that for me. And so the same, like, within 24 hours, or maybe 48 hours, I am now forced to come to his bedside to talk him down from when he is coming out of sedation, because he keeps freaking out. So the person who I hate with all my heart right now, I have to sit there and be super loving just so he can calm down and so we can get him out of sedation and so he can understand what's going on with him. And so I sat there for hours, repeatedly, Dan. Like, he would come out of it, it was intense. He saw me calm down a little bit, get more intense, sedate him again. And so it's one time, another time, like 6 or 7 times, I have to be like this loving person to calm him down, to remind him, hey, do you remember what happened? You know what? Okay. So we go through that. And then once he's come to and he's normal again, I leave and I just lose my mind again. It's just like, it's a lot right there. And so fast forward, he comes out of the hospital. It's been a week. He's having like memories that didn't actually happen, that they were happened while he was sedated, and thinking that it actually happened and asking me about them. And I was like, that didn't actually happen. I don't know what's going on. I made the decision for my own personal well-being to cut him out of my life. I don't need the drama that comes with, you know, whatever he's trying to rekindle or what have you. And so it was cut and dry. It was, once the papers are finalized, I do not want to speak to you. If we come across to each other, that's fine. We'll be civil, but I don't want to talk to you. Well, it turns out that after a while, he frankly just, actually, when I actually stopped talking to him is when I convinced him to get back on his HIV meds, because he was playing the little, you know, emotional whatever game where he was just, oh, I'm not going to take my meds anymore. I was like, yes, you're going to. So I talked him into taking his meds again. Once I knew that was good, stopped talking to him. Turns out after a while, he just stopped and never stopped drinking. And then the pandemic hit, and he had just broke up with somebody else he was dating, and so he never left his house. And so one time when that other guy he was dating came back to collect some of his stuff, he came out of the house after about 2 weeks, and he was green, and he had this big thing sticking out of his stomach. And this partner told him, or his ex told him, you should go to the hospital. He went to the hospital, and they just told him he's got about 2 weeks. And I hadn't heard anything until I heard, you know, from a friend of ours. And she told me what happened, and this is crazy, and it was stunning. And this is right in the heart of COVID, where you couldn't get into these places, right? Because unless you're like a mother or father, you can't get in. So his mom kind of finagled things and got me in there. And Dan, like, I gave him the best years of his life, all right? And then I left him,
And I have to be comforting to him on his deathbed. Like, it's crazy. He's 33 years old. And I have to ask him questions like, do you know why you're here? And he says yes. And he talks about, like, what he wants to do, you know, in his last days. And I'm just like, Jesus Christ. And the only thing that I can think of is, if I would have just communicated with you regularly, just communicated with you regularly and made you know that you weren't a piece of shit, that you would take care of yourself. And I mean, it's killing me, like phrasing, but it's killing me just sitting there looking at him. And I'm just like, I used to spend every day with him. And like, he's got, you see this D that I have right here? This is for him. And he's got an eye, I had an eye on his arm for me. And it was just like, I'm looking at it and I'm like, oh, it's crazy. Like, and you know, I don't put that level of blame on myself. But I, you know, I go through life and I'm just like, yeah, like, should I have, you know, reacted more to that? Or should just not to him, but I'm like, have I done enough to get past that? Am I still, you know, reacting to certain things in ways? Am I still overly emotional about stuff because I haven't handled that yet? And I don't, like, I'm pretty sure I've grieved properly and I've moved past it. I don't blame myself, but it's like, to think that people go through this stuff all the time. Like, there's a lot of people that have gone through stuff like this, and you hear, you know, these sports stories, and it's heartwarming. Oh, he lost his mom. But, like, put yourself in that moment for a second. And, like, yeah, people say, oh, you lost your ex-husband. Oh, okay, whatever, you guys were already. But, like, I sat there on his deathbed. And I'm frankly glad that I couldn't come back because I was, you know, allowed to come back another time, and then they caught me, and I just had to talk to him on the phone instead. But I just don't wish that on anybody, you know, and, like, I have a sister now who's not doing very well health-wise, and it's just one of those deals where it's just like, you can just sort of see the future, and I don't, you know, you don't like the way it ends. And so, you know, when people go through these things, and just got to give them, like, time and respect and just let them handle it, but also just, you know that a lot of things can shift you. It can change you. It can change you in the wrong way. It can change you in the right way. And so hopefully, you know, I feel like I've taken a lot of these traumas or whatever you want to call them and used them for the right way. But
it sounds like you loved correctly, that you loved deeply, that I don't have experience with grief. My wife has experience with grief, and she sort of describes it as like plants that grow up on your body and don't ever leave. Like
I don't know if, like, I'm looking at the grief eater thing right there, and that's supposed to be you. I don't know if I'm a grief eater as much as I just feel it. Like, you know, with my sister, for example, like I was just saying, you know, she's spent a lot of time in a hospital by herself and, like, monitored by herself and a couple of times restrained. And all I can think about is being in her head. You know, like, we really tight family growing up, and like, to put myself in her shoes where she thinks that maybe we're not there for her, or that we think that she's where she's supposed to be, and it's crazy.
Oh, but Iz, you've been so good to your family. Like, you've been so, I don't know where your guilt resides, I don't know the depths of it, but you have been so good to your family. And, you know, I without betraying any confidences, like, you've had some folks who have taken, it feels like, more than they have given.
I mean, not knowingly, you know. It's just one of those things where, and I was watching the Whitney Houston biopic the other day. I think it's called I Want to Dance with Somebody. And I didn't realize a lot of things about her. But when she said this whole, you know, I'm tired of being everything to everybody, I never get tired of that. Like, I'm okay if you need me for something. Like, I will be there for you. And so what... it just always gets me, like, I can't do enough. I can't do enough for my family. Like, even right now, like, you know, they're all living in my sister's house. My dad's sitting there. You know, my sister's coming in and out of the house. It's just kids everywhere. And I just feel like, man, I wish I had more.
But you've been responsible for that group of people for a long time. Like,
I have been. But then again, my older sister's working her ass off every single day, you know, housing all these folks. And she's working in, you know, the medical. She's a nurse, and she's seeing things at work that's super stressful, coming home and having life that's super stressful. And it's like, I look at her and I'm just like, she's doing more than I'm doing. She's doing more than I'm doing. And it's like, I never feel like I can do enough, or I am doing enough. But it's like, I guess that's where I'm at, just recognizing that life is hard. Life is just freaking hard. And, you know, not everything's going to go the way you want it to go for everybody around you.
And sometimes I feel a level of guilt of like, I should, you know, just do whatever I can to just help them, because I wouldn't be here without them. But then where would I be right now? You know, we'd all just be miserable together. And so it's just a weird balancing act.
Thank you for pouring out your soul here. I hope I didn't make it too deeply uncomfortable.
Now, Dad, I'm an open book, man. Like, I do this. I mean, we haven't even touched the scratch the surface.
We haven't scratched the surface yet.
I'm not even kidding. We haven't even talked about a few things, but, you know, we can come back.
All right, well, we'll have to do a part two. We'll have to do a part two that will end more with you feeling more of a soaring joy in your heart.
Instead of snot coming out my nose.
I love you, buddy.
I love you too, man.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.